This episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you by NowSite Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. Bring all your digital marketing to a new level with their simple three-click method. And by Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet, the secure high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
I do, yeah. So we have this business, November Labs, which is really sort of really cutting edge stuff. So that's all involved in blockchain developments and that kind of technology. We're working on things like sovereign identities and security issues and all kinds of things that are
really, because blockchain is being, I mean, everybody kind of knows it from Bitcoin and cyber currency, but it's now being used in other industries, right?
It is. It's becoming the backbone for all sorts of industries.
Can you give me some examples, since I'm like, you could talk Japanese to me and I would understand more about it than blockchain. But
so we've got things like the land registry going onto the blockchain now.
Okay. Property records, basically.
Property records, that kind of thing. I mean, a trivial thing, Porsche are looking at putting their odometer readings from their cars onto a blockchain. So that there's this sort of irrefutable, you know, you can't go along to a dodgy garage and rewind your clock.
It's interesting to think about, right? People change odometers, digital or not, right?
Absolutely,
and they mess around with it.
So that, so from the trivial to the really, you know, very serious, it's becoming the backbone of all sorts of technologies. And as the chain, it's become faster, you know, the different methodologies are now being employed to create the blocks. It's just becoming a more viable and practical solution to all sorts of things. And I think it's probably one of the most exciting and interesting bits of technology that I've worked with anyway. I think we really are on the cusp of some great breakthroughs.
Right. Well, a lot of the stuff you've worked on have centered around security, right? Data security and privacy and things like that.
Yeah. So that side of it fits nicely with that. But as far as, you know, things like payment systems,
right?
When you start to think about how you could use the security of the blockchain, you know, this sort of irrefutable ledger of what's happened at all times.
Now, without connectivity and the internet and all this type of stuff, blockchain couldn't exist, right? Because it needs to be on a system of connected computers that talk to each other and compare, right, on a regular basis.
It does, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I mean, a lot of this technology just simply...
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work. And they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests, where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
My name's Aidan Cartwright, and I'm, guess what you'd call, a serial entrepreneur. I left university not really knowing what I was going to do. And since then, I haven't really ever had a job. So I've always worked for myself, always had my own companies, and just had ideas that I've then developed with much smarter people than myself, and let other people usually run them. And I just sort of oversee things and make sure that they're not stealing. And it seems to be working out quite well so far.
All right, Aidan. So good morning in New Jersey. Good afternoon in London in the UK. I appreciate you coming on. But I want to talk about all the stuff that you're doing, because I think you're running or involved with six different companies right now, different aspects of things. I mean, you really are the serial entrepreneur that I've had on here. People say they're a serial entrepreneur. They own a business. They've owned other businesses. You literally have businesses going on at all times.
I, I do. They're all sort of vaguely interlinked. So they're all okay. Technology based, apart from the photographic stuff, which is that's my joy. That's my kind of escape valve. But the rest of them, yeah, they're all vaguely involved in tech, whether it's medicine or blockchain or whatever else. And we're trying to map together everything so that eventually we end up with some,
some cohesion to a master plan. So
exactly.
So let's go back when you grew up in England and, what's your background? How'd you get involved with business? And, what did you did study at university. So, how did you end up with no job? I mean, you basically own companies, so you don't go to work every day like most of us.
Went away to a boarding school.
Okay.
And left there, did pretty well, found education, relatively easy. So left there and went off to medical school. And as I say, really didn't gel with it. I thought that it was going to be exactly what I wanted to do for all my life.
Being a doctor, I mean.
Yeah, being a doctor.
Okay.
I got there and looked around and everybody was so stressed and, it was just the environment was shocking. I thought, wow. For the rest of my life, I just don't think this is me. So I ran away and in fact just went off. I was also in a band at the time. Now I'm a drummer.
Okay. I saw that on your resume.
Yeah. So I went off to Europe and ended up drumming for an American outfit actually called Holiday on Ice.
Okay.
A sort of ice skating show.
That was in the States?
That was in France.
Oh, in France.
All around France and Europe.
Okay.
My sister was a skater in it. My father was going out with one of the costume makers. So it was all,
that's
kind of
funny. Fancy.
So I did that for about 6 months and came back and then started an interior design company, which I knew absolutely nothing about.
Yeah, that's perfect. So you quit medical school and you're like, I'm going to go into interior design because that's very related to what I was studying.
Totally. But in those days, when you're young and you're confident, you just march and pretend you know what you're talking about. And people believe me. I used to operate in a very expensive part of London called Hampstead, which is where we lived.
Okay.
And I'd just sort of turn up and say, well, I think you ought to do this, this, and this. And for some reason, they believed me.
Okay.
And I ended up with a team of about 36 full-time staff and ran that for about 11 years.
Were you doing interior design of homes or businesses or?
Both. Both. Okay. So we were doing design, home and business, mainly home, which was more rewarding. The business was a bit sort of,
So you have no degree in design. You have no background. You're not an architect, nothing like that. You're not an artist, maybe a little bit. And so how do you sell that to people?
Well, as I say, you just put on a good suit and act confident.
Okay. Yeah, right.
and in the end, I ended up in being in sort of the world of interiors and all these magazines. And also on TV, I had a spot on something called The Big Breakfast, where you used to go in and talk about design ideas and stuff. So well beyond, punching well above my weight. Always.
Right. But you also hired people, obviously, that were good to work for you, that followed your dreams or what your vision was. Okay. Yeah. And that's important, right? You got to keep good people around you.
I've always hired people who are much better at stuff than I am. That's
right. That's what makes you successful.
Absolutely.
Sure.
You've always got to have. So anyway, after about 11 years, I mean, I think I'd had enough, really.
So you did that for a long time.
Yeah. There are only so many cushions you can match the curtains, and then you've got to get out before you go crazy. So I left that. And towards the end, I'd been heading towards the sort of the computerized, sort of doing virtual diagrams. Before, this is sort of pre-internet, but we were starting to work on programs for visualization and taking photographs and superimposing design into photographs and that kind of stuff.
But you need a computer to see it. You couldn't go on the internet.
And it was before it was kind of mainstream. And then through a really fortuitous meeting, literally I bumped into this Israeli guy called Amit Mendelsohn.
Okay.
Outside the tube station in Hampstead. I bumped into him and he turned around to me and he went, made this strange noise. And I thought, well, that's rude. So I said,
you literally bumped into him physically.
Literally bumped into him. But, I said, what's the problem? And he said, he had a Walkman in. So I said, if you took your Walkman out, we could have a conversation.
Right. Yeah.
So he said, no, I'm deaf. And he was completely deaf. But it turned out he was a genius programmer and he was working on the video codecs that we all take for granted now, like H.623 and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I said, well, look, let's grab a coffee and have a chat. So we did.
Okay. It's happenstance. And
he said, look, come on.
How'd you have a chat? He's deaf. He can read your lips?
He reads my lips.
Okay.
And if he turns his thing up really high, he can just about hear some sounds. But he's more or less totally deaf.
Okay.
But really a genius. I mean, this guy was so smart. Anyway, 2 months later, we'd set up this company OnView, and we were working together, and we developed all sorts of sort of video technologies. This is pre Skype and all that kind of stuff. It was all right. Via ISDN and fixed lines.
Well, he was in Israel at that
point? No, he was living in London.
Oh, he stayed in London. Okay, so he's in London, you're in London. Okay.
Yeah. And we ended up developing the first ever video link between Hollywood and the UK casting studios. So around Soho, they have these casting studios.
Got it.
And normally they'd fly a casting director over and he'd come and he'd do the whole thing.
Right.
So we developed a system that would fit on the auto cue of a camera.
Okay.
And the guy in wherever, Hollywood, California, could see what was happening in the casting room in England.
Right. Now this is easy, but then...
Then it was
on. Didn't exist. Right. There was no internet. You couldn't... Right. So you needed a direct connection, almost like a T1 line or much bigger, I guess.
Yeah. We're using triple ISDN lines all linked together. Yeah.
So basically point-to-point type of things.
A really heavy video codec. So, yeah. But it worked. It worked really well.
Okay.
That was the kind of start of the tech thing.
But he was the brilliant guy who could program this whole thing.
He was a genius. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was kind of the ideas man and also the salesman who would go in and
right.
say.
Right. He wasn't an outside guy.
Exactly.
A little hard. Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay.
So we went on from there and we developed a PC-based system called OnView, which we sold a fair amount of. We ended up in Vegas at Comdex, which I don't know if you've ever been to Comdex. It's called something else now, but it's the biggest tech show in the world. And that was kind of interesting because the same week Comdex was on was Porndex, which was the pornography industry.
Of course it was, in Vegas.
So you'd end up with like masses of tech people who were...
Right. All these tech geeks, right? And then the pornography.
Living next door to the pornography.
That's pretty funny.
It was always kind of an interesting week. Yeah, anyway.
So OnView was a software system.
OnView was a software system, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, linking video.
Got it.
So that was quite fun. And then from there, we went on to, he went back to Israel and we kind of went our own separate ways in the end. And
did you sell that, the company or the software, all the rights to it?
We sold it to an Israeli company. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And last heard they were sort of still going ish, but yeah. I'm not sure what's happened to it.
Well, that's a huge area for technological development. I mean, in all fields, you know.
You know, like a lot of things I've been involved with, we were kind of too early. I mean, look at Zoom now. Jesus Christ.
Right. I know.
Like, oh.
I know.
You know, given where we are today, it would have been fantastic to carry on. But, you know, that's life. It's fun.
Of course.
Yeah. So.
I actually had something. I went to Cornell, and the guy who developed Lyft also went to Cornell, but like 10 years after me. And when I was there, this was in the mid-80s. We recognized that people needed rides to get home and forth. They didn't have cars. So we developed this computerized ride system. I was a freshman and there was no internet or anything like that. So we would post them on the bulletin boards and the university shut me down because you couldn't run a business out of your dorm. But it turns out I was like 10 years behind the curve. And then 10 years later, he had the internet. He started it at schools. That's how they started it.
Is he still involved?
I got screwed out of that. Is what? No, I don't know if he sold the company, but the guy who started Lyft came out of Cornell. So,
yeah, wow.
Whatever.
So, could have been, should have been.
Could have been, right. Yeah. Born at the wrong time. So,
yeah.
So, you sold that company.
Sold that company. Business, and then through a mutual friend, bumped into this guy called Paul Musto, who, now Paul was a very interesting character. So, he used to run Jacob Suchard, the chocolate company.
Okay.
He used to run the European division, about £6 billion worth of business annually. And in the end, he bought the UK subsidiary from Jacob Suchard as a management buyout and ran what it was the biggest company in Bedfordshire at the time. Anyway,
what did they do, Aidan?
Chocolate and confectionery.
Oh, that kind of Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
He sold it. And moved to Jersey, tried to retire with his bags of money, and got completely bored. And then this mutual friend of ours said, look, you guys should meet because Paul's kind of entrepreneurial.
And this is what year?
This was in 1999.
Okay.
Yeah. So we got together.
Ago, 21 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, I know, a long time now, wow. Got together and formed a company called Link Information Systems.
Okay.
Without really a clue as to what we were going to do with this thing, we just thought, well, we'll form a company. We'll get some smart people in a room and see what happens.
So it was just like a technology company, but you didn't know what you were going to develop.
Yeah, it was. Okay. If you remember, it was the kind of it was the start of the internet bubble, you know. In fact, I remember one day we got dressed up in our suits and we walked around the city of London just looking for investment, like a sort of juggling crew. We'd say, well, we got this. Anybody interested?
Right. Like a shell company. We don't own anything. We don't do anything, but we want money.
They were throwing money at people.
Because I think I first heard of the internet like 92.
Yeah.
I was on a conference in Israel, ironically, with there were kids from Israel, U.S., and Europe. Right. And all the Europeans and the Israelis were talking about this thing called the internet. And I'm like, it can't be possible because I live in America. We hear about everything. I never heard of it. I come back and AOL's everywhere. And
there you go.
You know, so then you're talking about 7 years later. So, yeah. So things are just starting to pick up at really that point, right? No more dial up and all that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, but things were gone beyond. They were really starting to overheat. You know, I think it was a company called Boohoo who were selling basically T-shirts online. Yeah. And they were given hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
Of
anybody would throw money at anybody. So it, crazy.
Didn't matter what the idea was. Didn't matter how stupid it was.
Yeah.
I mean, a bit like now, really, you know.
To a certain extent, yeah. I know.
Yeah, exactly. So we eventually settled on this thing called the Signature Bank, which was an authorization system for payments. Which was really smart. I can't tell you too much about it because it's actually resurfacing now. But anyway,
Was it similar to PayPal type of technology? Or
similar. Yeah, it was a way of authorizing transactions without revealing sort of who you were. It was completely, so you couldn't be defrauded. It was just a secure system. Yeah, really smart way of doing all that kind of stuff. Anyway, eventually, we got rid of that with SoftBank in Japan.
So that was a system for banks to use?
It was for sort of MasterCard and Visa. But it was being developed. We developed it more or less the same time that Chip and PIN was being developed.
Makes sense. That was people were getting nervous that people were stealing. There was big data hacks at that point. Yeah.
Big data hacks. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we invented this. And then as a spin-off from that, we developed something called eSafe, which was a way of exchanging information, encrypting it and exchanging it electronically, but without using PKI, without using public keys and that kind of stuff. We had these sort of keyless encryption transactions, like a one-off dial pad, but a really clever way of doing it. And we had all these verticals. One was called Legally Safe, which you may even have heard of. We sold it into about 100 of the top law firms. Baker McKenzie had it. All sorts of people. And that was great fun. So that was a good thing. And then I moved on from there into medicine. Actually, ended up back in medicine doing infection control, which we're still doing now. This is the EpiQuest company, which operates in the States.
Yeah, you told me about that.
Yeah.
So that's a contact tracing type of a platform, right? To allow hospital systems and governments to contact trace probably without violating all their privacy rules.
Kind of. So what it does, it sits inside the hospital environment.
Okay.
And it basically just monitors all the electronic traffic that's happening in the hospital. So lab results, patient data, everything else. And it looks for patterns using kind of AI. It learns what patterns to recognize. And then it uses logic to say, well, this could be, you know, a C. diff infection or a MRSA or a COVID-19.
Oh, based on the data that it's collecting.
Yeah.
Okay. And then who's it report to? The CDC and says, hey, here's a flag.
We've got about 12 alerts that go directly to CDC and NHSM.
Okay.
So if it recognizes something that's, you know, on the alert list, it'll alert straight away. But fundamentally, it just alerts the infection control teams within the hospital.
Right. Now, how many hospital or hospital systems throughout the country are using it?
So there's 42 in the States.
Okay.
And we started rolling it out to the NHS a couple of years back.
Right. The National Health System in England. Yeah.
Yeah. The take-up has been woeful because they haven't got any money.
Right. Government.
Yeah. And also, you know, we went to Public Health England. The trouble with the NHS is that they're very good at fighting fires. So something happens and they charge over there and they put it out.
Right.
And then they get on to the next thing.
But that's Western medicine.
That's Western medicine.
Right. I was talking to somebody yesterday. Law is kind of the same way. We get involved when there's a problem.
Yeah.
The doctors treat you when you're sick.
Yeah.
They don't mind. That's what's the problem with this whole pandemic thing. If they had had your systems, they're monitoring things would start cropping up. They'd be notified immediately.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's tragic because there's one button in the system. So we'd call you up as a patient. There's one big red button which says contact. You press it, and it shows the history of everyone you've been in contact with throughout.
Yeah, see your that, and that we're going to need going forward, or we're never going to get this thing under control.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there is a recognition now that prevention is the way forward. The cure is, especially with antimicrobial resistance becoming a major issue globally.
Right.
You've got to start looking at prevention rather than cure.
Yeah, you don't want to get it because you can't treat it.
You've got to stop it spreading.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And we had a great example with our system in a hospital that remained nameless. But basically, there was somebody came in with tuberculosis.
Okay.
And they process something like 10,000 lab tests per day because they're doing other hospitals' work as well.
Right.
Anyway, this TB result got missed on the manual checks. But our system was running 24/7, never takes a tea break, never has a holiday.
Right.
And it just flagged up TB. Here's the patient. You go to the bed map, which shows the bed, where the person is. Click it, and immediately, you know, you can send the staff in with the protection and get this guy isolated.
Right, because it's very contagious.
The amount of money that saved, let alone lives.
Lives. Yeah.
Inestimable.
Right.
For the cost of a system, it's just like it's a no-brainer. Of course, you should have it. So
has this system been in place like? When MERS was around, the first SARS virus, like how long has it been used or developed and so forth?
Well, we're on version 3 now, which has been in for about 6 years.
Oh, okay. So it's been around for a long time. It's
been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like tracking this stuff is like new. It's not, they should have been doing it from the beginning. This is not, I mean, we should have seen, I mean, I'm sure people in your field and that field knew that something like this was coming. It's just the average person had no clue. And unfortunately, the president of my country just doesn't seem to care.
It's interesting because there's all these clips going around of your previous president, Barack.
Yeah,
who was, you know, let's face it, by comparison, an absolute genius.
Oh, yeah.
Who was saying...
He cares, that's why.
He cares. He's been saying for years, we've got to get ready for a pandemic.
Yeah.
And to be fair, even Bush said it. I mean, you know, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people, a lot of criticism of Bush, and he was a bit of a goofball, but he still cared. He cared about people in the country. That's the problem with the president now. He doesn't care. I don't want to get political, but I read an article by someone who was part of Obama's team, and I believe it's a woman, and she had said that when the administrations were transitioning from Obama to Trump, that they went with Trump's team, sat down with them, gave them they had put together an entire emergency plan. What's going to happen with the schools and the economy and all these different things and testing, what you got to be prepared for. They basically threw it out and just ignored what they, fine. And they pushed them out. You know, it's like when you sell your house and you're trying to tell the guy buying it, he's looking at the house. Listen, let me show you these systems because this is the problem. I've lived in this house for 20 years and these are the problems that I've had. And the guy goes, no, I'll figure it out. And then 4 months later, he calls you and says, hey, I'm having trouble with this. And you're like, well, what do you want me to do about it? I'm not in the house anymore. It's your house. And they didn't care. And I think that's one of the problems. So I think it's important to recognize that these tools were out there and they are out there, like with your software. We just got to get our SHIT together and start caring about people, you know?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're actually working on something now, EQL4, which is the latest or going to be the new iteration of it, which will take... based on patient flow. So it takes the patient from, you know, triage from right from the very start and takes it through, it takes the whole history right the way through the whole journey until outcome. Because again, what happens is you'll find at any hospital,
the
patient journey just gets lost.
Yeah.
So there's all these points of handoff of information.
Especially during crisis, right?
And it's an absolute
when they're
crisis.
Overwhelmed, yeah.
They're overwhelmed and things are getting dropped and so we have this system now with timer clocks on. You have to do things within a certain amount of time.
So are public health systems like the NHS using the system also?
Well, not yet is the honest, because, you know, the technology in the NHS is
their government.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's woeful, but it's certainly.
No, but it's government. It's
government.
It's different than private sector.
Yeah.
You know, profit there's a very, companies.
You know, the National Health Service in England, they're very nervous about private intervention.
Right,
and to a certain degree, I agree. I mean, it's the best thing we have. It's a fantastic service, and especially now, look at what they're dealing with. It's incredible.
Right. Yeah,
these brave people are out there and risking their lives for everybody. I mean, not just our country, but globally. It's
right. I'm hoping all this stuff. What comes out of this is a collaborative a collaborative, you know, community. I know there's been collaboration before, but never like this. So hopefully, you know, experts from around the world will be collaborating on a regular basis for all kinds of things that happen. And that's the only way, because I think you had told me these viruses aren't going away. They're going to mutate. There's going to be another virus. We're not moving off of Earth. We got to stay here. So,
well, unless the issues,
how do we deal with it in the future?
Unless you're a very good friend of Elon Musk. And then
he's going to. Do you see that kid? They had a baby, and you see what she named the baby? I said to my wife, that's not even a word. You can't pronounce that. It's so funny. And apparently it's more her, not him, that drove the naming of this baby.
I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing.
I don't know.
You'd want someone solid to be, you know, it's a sort of anchor and the Musk in place. I'm not sure if she's even weirder than him.
I think she might be. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Having said that, I won't have a bad word said against the man. I think he's a genius.
Yeah, he's a brilliant guy.
Good for the planet. Everything he does.
Because he seeks out new discoveries. He's changing the way, you know, the automobile industry, and maybe he'll change space travel. And now you got all these other companies that are doing it, right?
Yeah.
Branson and Bezos and all these guys trying to get to space first. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Musk has this thing. It's all for the good. I mean, he wants to just improve the planet, which, you know, hey.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Look, ego gets you going, but hopefully if you have a conscience and you care about other people, you can use that and your influence and your power and your wealth accumulation to do. He started with PayPal, didn't he? Isn't that where he first made his money?
Yeah. Well, he started off by writing
one of the people that got involved with that, right?
Yeah, he started writing a program when he was at school. When he was about 14, he wrote a game which he sold for, you know, a couple of dollars. But that started him on the path. Yeah.
Well, brilliant guy. All these guys are, you know, programmers. They know what they're doing. You know,
good guy. Yeah. And I think what happens with somebody like Musk, you know, you get to a position where, you know, he's got untold wealth.
Right.
In theory, I think a lot of it's on paper, but he suddenly realizes that actually that's not particularly fulfilling.
No, not anymore.
You see it with all these guys. They suddenly get to a point where they go, well, you know, it's a bit like fame. Well, I've got it. Now what do I do?
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg needs more money? No.
Well, he might be the exception, actually. I don't know what motivates that guy.
Bill Gates got to the point where he says, I don't need more money. I can change the planet now. So
yeah,
not running out, that's for sure. Yeah.
Elon's probably, he's at that point now. He wants to give away all his property or sell it all. I have no possessions.
Right.
And just do good. Well, hey, good.
Yeah,
good.
Fine.
Anything I can do to help? Elon, give us a call.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
All right. So we're back in, so when, what time period are we at now?
Where are we? We're 2008 or so up to present day with EpiQuest. That's still going strong.
Okay. But you have other businesses that are still running, right?
I do, yeah. So we have this business, November Labs, which is really sort of really cutting edge stuff. So that's all involved in blockchain developments and that kind of technology. We're working on things like sovereign identities and security issues and all kinds of things that are
really, because blockchain is being, I mean, everybody kind of knows it from Bitcoin and cyber currency, but it's now being used in other industries, right?
It is.
Okay.
It's becoming the backbone for all sorts of industries.
Can you give me some examples, since I'm like, you could talk Japanese to me and I would understand more about it than blockchain. But
so we've got things like the land registry going onto the blockchain now.
Okay. Property records, basically.
Property records, that kind of thing. I mean, a trivial thing, Porsche are looking at putting their odometer readings from their cars onto a blockchain. So that there's this sort of irrefutable, you know, you can't go along to a dodgy garage and rewind your clock.
It's interesting to think about, right? People change odometers, digital or not, right?
Absolutely,
and they mess around with it. Okay.
Yeah. So from the trivial to the really, you know, very serious, it's becoming the backbone of all sorts of technologies. And as the chain, it's become faster, you know, the different methodologies are now being employed to create the blocks. It's just becoming a more viable and practical solution to all sorts of things. And I think it's probably one of the most exciting and interesting bits of technology that I've worked with anyway. I think we really are on the cusp of some great breakthroughs.
Right. Well, a lot of the stuff you've worked on have centered around security, right? Data security and privacy and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that side of it fits nicely with that. But as far as, you know, things like payment systems,
right?
When you start to think about how you could use the security of the blockchain, you know, this sort of irrefutable ledger of what's happened at all times.
Now, without connectivity and the internet and all this type of stuff, blockchain couldn't exist, right? Because it needs to be on a system of connected computers that talk to each other and compare, right, on a regular basis?
It does, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of this technology just simply couldn't exist without the birth of you know, the internet and right. everything that's happened since. Yeah.
Yeah, well, nobody would have thought of it until
of course.
Now the internet exists. And they're like, oh, we could do this now. Yeah,
yeah.
Sure. Makes
of course,
sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
what other industries are they using it in? Not necessarily you guys, but have you seen it being used or looked at? They're talking about it in law for some reason. I guess with documents, you know, large transactional documents and things that are being done back and forth, there's no way to track. I mean, there's a way to track, but it's bad. You have a 300-page document. It's very hard to use like Google to track the changes that you're making with a team of 50 attorneys that are working on a big transaction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, almost any industry you can think of. I mean, for a while there, it was a bit like, you know, the sort of bubble before, but if you attach blockchain to anything, you could get investment. And some of the big banks were just, you know, they'd see a company that were using a blockchain for something and they'd just buy it because they thought, this is an investment.
Right.
And I think a lot of them have been burned with their enthusiasm.
Yeah, but they didn't understand what they were buying, which is very common. Yeah.
But if you think of anything that kind of uses a database as some part of its process,
yeah,
that part of it can be used or replaced with this distributed network of ledgers for blockchain.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And now a word from our sponsors. NowSight Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. It's everything you need to market online, and it's totally automated. Build custom websites, optimize them for Google rankings, and automatically create ads and social media posts to drive the most traffic to your sites. Their fully integrated system generates regular email newsletters, manages all your customers and prospects, and provides up-to-date marketing analytics. NowSight. You do your thing, and we'll do the marketing. Use our affiliate link in the show notes to learn more about NowSight and how it can help your business. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's LAW to 21000. Or follow our link in the show notes to learn how you can get this valuable tool for you and your company. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their link in our show notes to learn more and get connected with Fetch. And now back to our show.
And you can have, you know, levels of efficiency that you can't even think of at the moment. I mean, just because it's the way the whole thing is strung together. So without sort of getting technical about how the whole thing works, you really can slip it into almost anything you can think of that needs that kind of authentication and registration.
And that's what November Labs is working on.
That's what November Labs. Specifically, we're working on things like sovereign identity, which is where you create, I mean, in brief, you create an identity.
Okay.
Which is you.
Right.
And then you get that identity confirmed by all sorts of authenticating bodies like the passport office, your driving license, the gas supplier, and all, so that eventually your identity becomes a trusted entity. And that exists as a hash on a blockchain.
Okay.
And it can be referred to by authenticated parties, and they know it's you. And then that becomes something. In fact, Tim Berners is working on something at this moment, which is using this sort of methodology.
So does it eliminate identity theft?
That's the idea in the end. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You'll be able to, you know,
have confidence that people can't steal because they try to. There's the system's going to match it up, and it's not going to work. It's going to be data. Misinformation.
Exactly right. So the hash doesn't match and they say, oh, okay, something's wrong.
Right.
It doesn't
so match. Really what blockchain is, it's a giant database that's constantly checking its information against other copies of the database. And if it doesn't match up, it's going to raise a red flag.
That's sort of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's if you imagine, how would I describe it? What's the easiest way to describe it?
Like a ledger, you said, is like lines it's on it, like, and everybody has entries.
A giant ledger that's completely public; everyone can see. and it keeps itself in check because it's permanently being compared against all the other people who hold the ledger, which is everybody.
Right.
So this thing is distributed everywhere, and any change has to be authenticated and agreed upon.
But how does, so then how does it differentiate between agreed upon, accepted changes and those changes that are fake or hacked or not accepted? How does it differentiate between that? How does it know that you and I are making a change that's authorized and other people are not?
Yes. Well, that's getting,
that's another episode
into the roots. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll do it.
Very complicated, right?
Yeah. But in fact, I've got a nice little YouTube explanation that we did. Little.
Oh, good. So you'll give me a link and I'll put it in the show notes and
I'll give you a link. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Exactly how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. It took me a very long time to even understand what blockchain was because, you know, it was just, I mean, I understood it from a cybercurrency, cryptocurrency, you know, a standpoint. But then when they started talking about, oh, well, you can use it in other industries, I'm like, how can you do that? So,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, no, it is. It's fascinating technology, yeah.
So, other companies. I know I saw on your resume, there's like six companies going on, so.
Yeah, so we have a company called AppyZebra, which is it fun? I suppose it's fun. But we developed, we're still developing all sorts of applications and solutions we've got one which is a sort of a brand new way of looking at how to get the best deal when you're out there shopping.
Yeah. Okay.
So we have a team of people who are just looking for solutions and we build them.
Because I saw the website's not even up yet. It's really new. No. I found it says coming soon. There's a zebra there.
Yeah.
But it's similar to like Honey. If you're familiar with Honey, it's not an app.
I'm familiar with Honey.
Plugin. Yeah. So it kind of looks for coupons and discounts and you don't have to do it. So yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I wish I could tell you exactly how it works, but I can't yet because we're looking for an American partner.
Yeah. Okay.
So we just launched in the UK about 2 months ago. And it's going well, it's growing fast. And now we're looking to do a deal with a U.S. company to take a license for the U.S.
All right. Well,
so offline
we could talk because I have a lot of connections.
Oh, do you?
Not to necessarily directly, but connections to, all kinds of people that are looking to get involved with different type of stuff like that. But it's basically a development company also, but it's to develop applications in certain.
Exactly.
You know, for use that way. Okay. Yeah. So that's AppyZebra. We'll have to watch for that one.
Watch for that one.
That's three. We're halfway there.
Is that all? Gosh.
Yeah.
And then the passion project is real photography, real PR, and real gear. Okay. So real photography is I worked with a guy, Nick Gibbons, who is a renowned photographer, really very, very good photographer.
Okay.
Special photographer. And we were talking about all kinds of stuff. He was actually the business development director for Allianz, the insurance giant.
Yep.
But he got to a stage where, you know, he's paid his mortgage off and he's done his dues.
Got a few dollars left over.
Got a few dollars in the bank. And we were talking about wanting to do some stuff together. And I said, Nick, your photography is, I mean, he's a fully, you know, accredited photographer. He's done all the exams or whatever it is.
Right.
I said, you're crazy. Why don't we do something with that? So we formed Real Photography a year and a half ago. And it's just been amazing. It's been fantastic. So
what is it doing, or what are you guys doing?
So we're corporate photography.
Okay.
Anything you can think of, really, in the corporate world, we do. We've started to. It's more of Nick's out there doing the real clicking photography,
right?
But we've become a bit of an agency now, so we're hiring some really good photographers. At the moment, we're doing absolutely nothing, of course.
You can't go on location now.
Nobody wants any photographed at the moment.
Right.
But that led into, we thought, well, actually, you know, creatively everything starts from the image. So we create beautiful images. And then we've recruited some other people to form Real PR, the PR company. So we now do the whole kind of, you know, social media and PR and stuff. So we're starting to build that up in
digital marketing, building websites, the whole thing, right?
Exactly,
yeah. So are you also building like an image library where people can purchase, licenses to use? Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah,
right.
We do that. And we're building a team based in London. But the idea is to offer the full PR service. Because I think, you know, with any business now, it's absolutely essential. You just can't you can't run unless you have all this stuff in place.
No, there's no question about it.
Yeah. So the idea is to become this sort of full service company.
It's like, say, I'm going to buy a store and I'm going to board it up.
Yeah.
You know, the people will find me anyway.
I mean, exactly.
You definitely have to be out there. Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's some kind of do-it-yourself stuff you could do at the beginning when you get started. But if you really want to build a business, you can't be doing things yourself forever because it's just not a good way to do things.
Do you know, it's amazing. So for Appy Zebra, we started off getting an external marketing company in to do the marketing side of it.
Right.
And soon realized that, in fact, we needed a team of our own because, so there's a couple of, well, a guy and a girl, actually, and their entire job is just Facebook. I mean, just Facebook, because it's a full-time occupation. You know, you've got to engage and you've got to be interesting and you've got to post all this. I can't be bothered with it, but it's just like, it's a full-time profession now for people.
Of course.
Just to manage.
It's not even social media. You're right. It's like one platform. One person can't do all the platforms. They're too busy with the one. So what are they looking for? They're looking for development opportunities for you guys to work with people. Is that what they're marketing for Appy Zebra?
Yeah, no. Well, they're pumping out information about what we're up to. So
more content, PR.
Yeah, so marketing. To make the platform work, we have to have retailers and users on board. Okay. And the more we can get of each, then the bigger the platform becomes. So their job is literally just to pump out information and to manage the whole conversation of what's going on day to day.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
It's a full-time thing. Wow.
So you have the PR marketing, digital marketing company.
Yep.
The photography company. Those are two different companies?
They're two different companies, but they're kind of joined at the hip.
Okay. And what's the sixth company?
Well, the sixth company is something called Flaming Phoenix, which is actually my main company.
Right now? It's your main focus?
That's sort of where everything, that's where everything sits. So
okay.
Flaming Phoenix is my baby, which I think I started in 2011. And that is just a tech company that just does anything tech comes through the door, goes through Flaming Phoenix. And then we send it to wherever it's got to go.
It's like a portal towards the other companies.
It is.
Gathering. So is there any, because as a lawyer, is there any like method to the madness? I mean, is there a parent company and then the subsidiaries, or you just own different parts of different companies? And
I'm wrong
with that. I'm just curious.
No, there's no common link.
Link.
Yeah. So I try to keep the controlling interest of all of them, just so that I can have my say. But as I said to you before in our sort of chat before, that the really important thing I've always believed is to get people in who are better than you.
Right.
And just let them run. Give them enough of the company to be interested so they don't want to run away and do it themselves.
Sure.
And then just say, right, off you go. Go and do it. And then check in, daily or weekly or whatever it takes just to make sure it's all on track. But so far, it's been good to me.
Yeah. You're like the Richard Branson of the things that you're doing. But didn't you have a story you had met him before once or through your dad?
Well, my dad was my dad, Stephen Cartwright, was a very famous actor in the 50s, 60s.
Okay.
So at the time there were literally two TV, BBC, TV stations.
Right.
And he was on both. So he was the Knight Errant on one, which was this dashing detective who used to run around town rescuing women.
Okay.
And on the other channel, he had a chat show called Late Night Lineup with a couple of other people.
Okay.
So he was a man about town. He was sort of meeting everybody. And he also had a construction company. And I'm not quite sure how it happened, but he ended up designing and building Branson's first ever recording studio called the Manor House down in Oxfordshire.
Ah.
And brought in a guy called Tom Newman, who was the producer. Dad also had a jazz club in Chelsea called the 606. So he knew all these musicians and all the rest of it.
Right. You play there because you said you're
yeah,
music.
Yeah. 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 Played down there quite a lot.
Right.
And then Tom sort of introduced Mike Oldfield, who was the guy who did Tubular Bells. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't think so, but I'm not a music guy. So
that was the first album that Branson was involved with. And that eventually became the theme tune to The Exorcist. and became the biggest selling album of all time, I think, until Fleetwood Mac came along. And basically started Branson's career. I mean, that was kind of the album that gave him the cash.
Yeah, his first, Virgin Records was his first.
Yeah, yeah.
The music business was his first business, right?
That was his. Well, he had a student magazine, which he nearly went
to. Oh, right. I'd read about that. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was the start of Virgin. And without all of that, who knows where he would have been. It's quite funny.
Do you ever meet him?
I met him when I was about six, running around the garden. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
but,
funny.
He was an interesting chap. Yeah. He's not that popular at the moment over here because...
No?
Well, I think everyone's a little bit miffed that he's out there looking for handouts to save his airlines when...
Right.
I think people think he should probably put his hand in his pocket. And
yeah, why he would be the one guy who could fund everything until this whole thing passes. He's got plenty of money.
Yeah. He also sued our NHS for a couple of billion or something for a failed contract. So he's got to be... He needs to work on his PR a little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So it's interesting because I find when I meet a lot of people, it takes a certain person to, continue to pursue opportunities. Like, you did something, right? You followed probably what was told to you to the traditional path. You go to university, you study this, you learn, oh, I guess I want to be a doctor. And then most people don't have it in them to change. They end up being a doctor and they're not happy.
Well, the thing is, the reason I wanted to be a doctor, again, I think it was about six at the time, when my mother worked with a doctor, Dr. Alexander, who was Dr. Dick, this Greek, very wealthy Greek guy, who had a private practice in Harley Street, which is our big medical.
Okay.
And he had six Jaguar XJ6s, were they actually?
Right.
One for each color of the week.
Yeah, so you were enamored by that.
So cool. I've got to be a doctor.
You got to be a doctor. Yeah.
I want six Jags, one of every color.
Right.
So that was, and then my focus.
You're like, oh boy, this is going to be hard.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, this really? I've got to do all this for 5 years, 7 years?
Right. Maybe I can find another way to have the Jag.
Joking.
Yeah. Yeah, but to your credit, because I was talking to a guy yesterday, younger, he's 30, just getting started in business. And the funny thing is, his company is also a digital marketing company, but he's the kind of guy who doesn't sleep at night. I mean, he thinks of, there was a problem with his dog because his dog wasn't eating well. So he developed some, more natural food product, but he didn't just make it for his dog. So he's like, well, how can we market this and develop it? And now they're building a pet products company. And then he's starting another company. And, it's just like a certain mentality where instead of you saying, okay, well, here's my business, I'm going to go to work every day and work on this one company, you said other people could do that. I'm going to get the ideas and start them up and check on them later and keep them running. And I mean, that's really what an entrepreneur is. I think the word entrepreneur is overused.
I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, my best ideas are when I'm having, a 2-hour bath. So I'm just sitting
there. Clear.
You're just lying. I'm just thinking, well, and then something pops and you think, can we do that? I think we probably can. Yeah.
Right.
So map it out on a piece of paper.
Yeah. And but then, most people can't step away from their business enough. To clear
that's
their
very
head.
True. I genuinely think that most people work too hard
they
to
do.
Be successful. I think that's a truism.
Yeah.
Your head down, you're 9 to 5 or 9 to 11 or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's not 9 to 5.
Well, we lived in Boca Raton Delray Beach, actually, just up the road.
Yeah, you were telling me because my wife's from South Florida.
There you go. Yeah, for 3 years. And the Americans work like stink. I mean, you're in much more than we do.
Right. No, we don't. So in your part of the world, people work to live.
Yes.
In our country, we live to work. It's not healthy. And you don't know any better. You go to school and you get your job and you go to the company. And sure, there's entrepreneurs and that and people, but it's a small community. So the average person spends their whole life going to work and it's all about paying for the costs, cost of living and college and all this type of stuff is so astronomical. People spend their whole life living. They can't save money anymore. They don't have companies putting money away for them.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's disaster. True. And then this stuff happens. It's going to be interesting to see. I don't know if it's going on there, what this impact is going to have on the university system, because I think people are opening their eyes and saying, wait a second.
Yeah.
What the hell are we paying for? These kids are good. What do they need to go back here for? University of Phoenix online. They don't need to spend $80,000 a year going to university. It's like a big party.
So how is your, because your medical system obviously is all based on billing. I mean, that's,
yeah, you know,
it's all insurance and billing, which I could never understand. But anyway, how is it coping with this crisis? I mean, how do people, what happens? Do you give your credit card when you go in, or what's?
No, you don't. No. In most cases, if you're in a hospital system that's participates in your network, they're deductibles. So some people have higher deductibles in order to keep premiums down. The businesses have raised deductibles. So you may have a $1,500 deductible, but for a family, it's $5,000 or $8,000. So you could end up with a pretty big bill. I mean, they've waived some of the testing for COVID and whatever, but yeah, and especially on the hospital side, it's not like you pay $50 to go into a hospital. So you could end up with a $10,000 bill. That's only your share. The bill was $150,000. They have to discount it because the insurance company sets the rates, but then you got to pay $10,000. There's going to be a lot of people have a lot of problems financially, bankruptcies, deals they're going to have to make. The hospital's going to have to eat it in a lot of cases. People just aren't going to have the money.
I think, did I read that the biggest single form of bankruptcy in the States is because of medical bills?
Yep. Sure. That's what it is. It's not business bankruptcies, because a lot of people don't have their own companies. They're,
right.
It's medical bills. Gosh. They even passed. So years ago, you if you went into a hospital and you died and you had $25,000 worth of medical bills, your spouse might not even be liable for it if there was no assets in your estate. So there was case law that came about, and a lot of lawsuits that they came about, and they said, listen, these are what we call necessaries, and the spouse should have an expectation of having to pay these, or nobody's going to take care of dying people in the hospital. So, but even then, spouses say, listen, I don't know what to tell you. We don't have any money, and I'm trying to live, and, you know, things like life insurance, stuff like that, that's protected. So, you know, but that's like we talked about the economic impacts. That's going to be a big impact on the healthcare system. Sure. It's expensive now.
Yeah.
God knows what's going to happen with premiums. And that's the whole push to going to a national system like you guys have over there. But it's very hard to convert. Yours has been in place for, you know,
years.
What, 100 years or whatever, maybe more.
Well, yeah, sort of post-war, yeah. Okay. I remember when I was there, I people were scared of socialized medicine. They just thought it was communism.
No, it's not communism.
Coming in through the back door. And they were like terrified of having such. I could never understand why, and I could never get it over to people, that if you have an insurance company in between you and your bill,
right,
clearly it's going to be more expensive because the insurance company's got to make some money. Otherwise, they're not interested.
Correct.
So when you do comparisons, for example, on drug prices in the UK and the US, you're paying, you know, 10 times more.
Ridiculous number.
For your drugs because it's coming from an insurance company, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I've never really understood how your health system works or why it works the way it does. It seems very...
You know why it works the way it does? Because it is capitalism out of control.
Yeah.
Out of control. You have drug companies make billions of dollars a year. Insurance companies, none of which are going to post a loss for this. You guarantee that it's not going to happen.
Oh, sure.
What they really should do is they should, I don't know, make them all go nonprofit, and the CEO can get a certain salary. Maybe it'll be millions of dollars, but it doesn't have to be hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and it should go back to the policyholders. Maybe they're approaching it from the wrong standpoint, you know, from trying to do it from the government standpoint, you know, what you call, I guess, democratic socialism, which is kind of socialism with private enterprise. But something's going to give, and this is going to make it crack quicker, this whole pandemic thing.
Yeah. It's sad because it does, you know, I'm not sure it makes for the best people in the world. I mean, we had a case
recently where
a family from Seattle flew over to the States with their grandfather who had Alzheimer's and then left him in London on his own and flew back.
So he could be treated.
Yeah, they just left him in the street and eventually was picked up by a hospital, but they couldn't afford, they'd run out of money.
Right.
They didn't know what to do.
And then the government just picked him up.
The government in England picked him up and put him in a hospital and looked after him. But you think, God, to be driven to that is just extraordinary.
It's terrible.
Really? Yeah.
It's terrible. Insane. Now we're going to have problems going forward. But I think that it's interesting because all the stuff you're doing, I think, is they're change the world kind of stuff. So not all of it, but, you know, it certainly got that focus to it, you know.
Well, yeah, we like to think big.
You want to develop new things, new ways of doing things.
Look,
the world has to be a secure, more secure place because as people are on these video chats, and now you and I are doctors, so we're sharing data and x-rays and personal information. Somebody jumps in and grabs it. I mean, all that stuff's going to be issues going forward.
Yeah, yeah.
which I guess you recognize that. That's why you're doing the things you're doing.
There's a very fine balance with all this stuff. So, you know, whenever we're thinking about a technology, whether it's blockchain or security or sovereign identity, there's always a flip side. You have to think about when it becomes, if and what, you know, the potential for it to become weaponized.
Right.
Is always in the back of your mind because, you know, like now we're giving away so much of our privacy, which we probably have to overcome COVID and all the rest.
Yeah.
But you've got to be careful about the backside of that. What happens next? You know, yep. I mean, if you look at what's happening in China, where everybody's got an app and they social scoring and they're using facial recognition, you're not allowed on a train if you have below a certain score and you can't get a job. I mean
that's just, Big Brother's watching.
Ugh, it's terrifying. So there's always a, you know, we're always very cognizant of the fact there's a flip side to all this. You've got to be very careful to look for a path that makes sense and that can't actually be weaponized.
Well, there's people out in the world, whether it's China, Russia, or other parts of the world, that's all they do. They just try and break things and get in and take advantage of. So if there's a new system, you know, even Zoom, which, you know, has improved its security, they weren't ready for this kind of use.
No.
You know, they were just a small company. They're growing. Now they're benefiting from all this stuff, but that's why all these Zoom bombings happened, because the security wasn't there, because it wasn't intended to be used at this kind of level.
Exactly.
At least not yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So they had to catch up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zoom's an interesting case. You know, they came from absolutely nowhere almost.
And I didn't hear it. So it's funny. I have a friend of mine who's 78 years old, believe it or not. And he trains people on networking and he's done all kinds of stuff. He's with McKinsey. Actually, if you listen to the first two episodes of my podcast, it's with this guy, Jack Killian, fascinating story. You'll hear the whole story. He actually sold his company, one of his companies, to a couple of British conglomerates and he's been all over. So, but he's training all these executives around the country. He's like, I use Zoom. I said, what's Zoom? Like, I never heard of it. And then he's at home all on the screen and they interact and what, and now it's part of our life.
It's amazing.
Part of the fabric of our life.
And a really good lesson for
this way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Great lesson for everyone as well, because Skype, which was, you know, clearly dominant.
Yeah.
And
where are they?
But their UI is so bad.
Yeah. That's the problem.
This you send a link to your granny and she goes click and
yeah,
you're talking.
Yeah, even Microsoft Teams is better. I was on Google Hangouts the other day. It was terrible. Yeah.
Terrible.
I couldn't figure out. I mean, I guess because I'm a Zoom person, I couldn't figure out how to change the screen. And then I'm up here in the little box up there, I guess. And then everyone else is bigger. And it was a pain in the ass.
You know, my dear mother,
is important.
I've battled for years with my mother, who's definitely not a techie at all. But so I've given her a tablet and a smartphone and everything. Yeah. You know, she likes a piece of paper and a pen. And then she sat me down. She said, look, so she had a laptop open and she had Outlook, which I'm sure you use every day.
Yeah, of course. I don't. And I use Google, but I used to use it with my old firm. Yeah, we use Outlook.
But in fact, it is so complicated.
Yes.
If you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
And I said, well, you talk, mother, and I'll listen.
She doesn't think like you. That's the problem.
I said, tell me what the problem is. She said, well, look at it. There's buttons here and there and this thing. And what does this mean? What does that mean? How do I do that? And she's absolutely right. You need a small child.
Right.
And this is, I think, where Steve Jobs was so clever.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing he made it simple.
He recognized.
My kid was in an airport at age 3 and he went up to the TV, up to the big screen, and he tried to swipe it to change channel.
Right. Exactly.
And you think, that's
I've seen kids do that in the shopping malls when, I mean, some of them are touchscreen now, but they weren't. They were all these digital screens. The kids were going up and they were trying to touch it and move things.
There you go.
It moved. They couldn't figure it out. It's funny. The other day, now that you said that, my mom, she's 76 and she's been doing these Zoom calls with her Mahjong group and her bridge club, whatever. So she goes, I could do this one on a conference call. So I said, all right, use freeconferencecall.com and you go there and set it up. So she goes on the computer, she sets the thing up. So she calls me, she goes, now what do I do? And I realized that she didn't realize that it was a phone, like that you just call on the phone and you use the number. She was trying to figure out how to do it through the computer. And I said, no, you said you needed a phone call. You use the telephone. You know what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wasn't thinking the way she was thinking. She was thinking, oh, I must click something and then it takes me through the computer. Exactly. How does this call through the phone? I go, it doesn't. You got to use your phone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's very, you know, that's the generation gap. And I guess we'll see it with our children because they didn't grow up with the technology. It existed when they were born. So. Yeah. They don't know what tracks look like and cassette tapes and CDs even.
You know, I'm in the tech business. That's what I do day in, day out. If anything goes wrong in my house, I just get my 13-year-old. I just say, look, come in.
Yeah.
Fix it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, Dad. done.
It's pretty fun.
Thanks very much. Good.
Yeah, it's pretty
I mean, fun. Don't tell him, but it's partly because I can't be bothered. So
yeah,
I want him to feel like he's a hero.
If you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is a production of Mitchell C. Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.